Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Kareem El-Hakim risked his life to shoot footage in downtown Cairo for his documentary about the Egyptian Revolution. Allison Clayman and Stephen Meng managed to film documentaries inside China. One is about an extremely popular and periodically jailed artist, and the other is about two bloggers who risked their personal safety to expose stories censored in the state media. So, what happens when documentary directors get in the middle of this cat-and-mouse game between dissidents and government censors? The Global Journalist Forum at the True False Documentary Film Fest featured these directors, along with Josh Fox, the director of an expose about natural gas fracking called Gasland. What follows are highlights from the panel discussion, which was moderated by Jason Spingarn-Koff. He's a doc director and video journalist for the opinion section of the New York Times. He asked the directors about the credibility of their work compared with the mainstream media. Stephen Meng pointed out that documentary filmmaking is inherently subjective. Meng is a Korean-American who spent several years working on his film, High Tech Low Life. It's about two of China's most well-known bloggers, known as Zola and Tiger Temple. And they're tech-savvy enough to evade internet censors, but are leading very Spartan lives. Here's a cut from this forum.
I think it's important to always keep in mind that, like, when you're making or watching a documentary about a very sort of critical issue, that you remember, like, you know, we are sitting here whittling down 600, 1,000 hours of reality-based material into 1 hour. And so it's this hugely subjective representational art. We only are guided by some sort of like moral compass within ourselves, and we vet it as best as we can. But it's not the truth. I mean, this is our version of it. It's what we saw, and it should be taken as that, I think.
The forum was sponsored by the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. So there were student journalists in the audience who were wondering about their practices. Allison Clayman, the director of Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, said documentary film directors have a basic similarity.
You know, for a young person who's going into all this, and despite maybe some of the tenor, which I also think is true, what we were saying before, I mean, I do find value in the part of me that also I consider myself a journalist, and I think, because I think of it in the best way, you know, I mean, if you come in, I think everybody sitting here is... did filmmaking that also adhered to, again, it's about the principles less than the label, but the fact that you do really care about, you know, the accuracy of what you're doing. It's not in name that you show another side because you have to, but if you're really in pursuit of the truth and getting your facts right, I mean, that to me is just the most important and part and parcel with, you know, documentary filmmaking, which I think is nice because it frees you from the constraints of journalism, which are sometimes very practical, like time limits and space and all those kind of things. And the fact that, you know, as a creative person, you can make it however you decide you want to make it and then see if people, you know, if that works for people. But I think that seeing yourself also as a journalist for all the things that good journalism stands for is so important for documentary for me.
Also pointed out why maverick social media reporters like Zola and Tiger Temple are needed in countries that control the established press.
Yeah, it seems like there's, you know, different levels of this sense of the failure of journalism, especially, you know, you can be in China or the U.S. and journalism or wherever, and journalism is supposed to be that last protective barrier between you and the government or you and powerful corporation and it fails us constantly, repeatedly. You know, one of the first things that my younger character Zola had said to me early on was that, like, you know, in China all news is good news, and he thinks that's crap. You know, and there's a huge distrust, obviously, in China for the mainstream media, and that's, I think, a shared sentiment here. You know, we question this sort of model now. I think everybody questions this sort of top-down hierarchical delivery of information, and we clearly live in this networked sort of world, and information is not just coming from the top down, but going in all directions. And how do you vet that is another question.
And Karim El-Hakim is the co-director of Half Revolution, and he never planned to film a documentary about the mass protests that brought down Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. He and his friends brought their cameras and camera phones to Tahrir Square as participants to simply record what they were doing during a sit-down demonstration. But they ended up filming in secret for the next 10 days. He said citizen journalists in Egypt are circumventing the deeply mistrusted state media.
In Egypt right now, there's very much a media war going on, okay, within the amongst the population of the official state TV line and the official government papers and everything, and then everybody else, not including the foreign press. I'm talking about Egyptian citizen reporters. And of course, you know, the state has a monopoly about over television and a lot of the papers and a lot of what is said in even the independent papers. So what's happening now is kind of a movement called Kazibun, which means liars. And these are just citizen activists that have lots of clips and photographs and of certain events that happened in Egypt where a lot of people died and got, you know, whether they were driven over by tanks or they were, you know, died in a soccer stadium or they were shot at in the street. All of that footage is completely like censored and illegal to show. And I think there's also some complicity in from Western media to also kind of censor that material and not show that material. I think it's, you know, it really depends on how politically convenient the story is at the moment. But what people are doing in Egypt is they're literally going out into the streets and projecting these videos onto walls of buildings, onto statues, onto, you know, walking around with laptops and sitting down and showing people that don't have access to satellite TV or internet. And showing them the photographs of dead Egyptians or showing them videos where people are getting killed by the army or the police. And this is just a grassroots movement. And it's a total circumvention of this, you know, institutionalized news that we're all tired of. Because, you know, when we watch state TV, I watch it just to see what the lie is this week. You know, it's like the complete opposite of the truth. So it can tell us, it's very insightful to watch this stuff because it gives some kind of, you know, it gives me insight into how is the regime thinking, you know. But of course the opposite is being done by citizens. So we're really, there's a real tug of war for perception of minds and changing minds because so many Egyptians really just rely on the state TV media, this kind of terrestrial television, and they don't really question it. They just kind of take it as truth, even though it's complete opposite of the truth.
Moderator Jason Springer and Koff then delved deeper into the role of social media.
Yeah, I think that gets us to this key issue of, Stephen, in your film, and I think in your film too, the amount of, you know, citizen reporting, citizen media. These are non-professional journalists. And by not being a journalist, they actually had advantages. You would get advantages as a credentialed journalist. In your situations, it was the non-credentialed journalists who had certain advantages for reporting the truth.
Yeah, actually, I think if I was an accredited journalist, I probably would have been, you know, targeted and probably beaten up much easier. I mean, they knew where they were, and those guys, they got their heads cracked open, you know, and their stuff was smashed, and things that happened to like Anderson Cooper and his cameraman. I mean, I never seen a guy get, you know, his face was just completely purple and swollen and really got beaten bad, really bad. And it's because they were registered journalists, you know. We actually, when we got arrested, the night we got arrested, we had cameras on us. They didn't frisk us. They didn't notice that we had the cameras. And Omar actually had a press card, a Danish press card. I said, don't use that. Don't use that. Unless they find the camera. Don't say, just tell them you're a tourist. You know, that's what we did. I mean, we simply just lied our way through and became, you know, tried to stay as anonymous as possible. And I think that was the only way to really get the story, is just try to be as invisible as possible and avoid detection. You know, as soon as you're on the radar, people follow you, and it's much harder to kind of get things done. That's why a lot of these shots that everyone experienced on TV were made from, you know, five-star luxury hotels with a very long zoom lens off the balcony. And these were the only things that kind of that we could see on the news, because it was simply too dangerous for those accredited journalists to be in the street. You know, so we had the advantage of really just being anonymous and being able to kind of, and also it's my neighborhood, so I know a lot of the people, and I can hide quickly. I know my way around town, and so that really allowed us to get these things, you know, done.
Stephen, do you want to talk about why your subjects say we are not journalists?
It's much the same reason, you know, like Tiger Temple in particular says that very line, you know, if why would I bother calling myself a journalist? I mean, once they, or a citizen journalist even though he knows very well it's something he partakes in, it's, you know, that would soon enough, if everybody started doing that, lead to certain laws being passed that put certain restrictions on that kind of activity, and it put it into sort of that hierarchy of the spectrum of newsmaking and what people can and can't do within that spectrum.
I think someone says to Zola, I'm glad you're here because the journalists came and they didn't do anything. And they were so grateful that he had come to report on, I think it was pollution and farmland. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, and I took a lot of cues, all my cues from both of them. Wherever they went, you know, they would not posture to be anything more professional than what they were, like just a couple of dudes riding bikes around the country and city taking pictures when they felt like it. You know, on the flip side, if you want to, you know, if you're in China and you want to speak to the bureau chief of the AP or something, you know, it helps to seem more professional. But I'm not, you know, I'm just a filmmaker, so in reality.
I think what's interesting about this, though, so why is it that being a journalist then is a dangerous thing? To authorities, let's also talk, maybe not necessarily to like a mob on the street, which there might be other things that are going on there, but, you know, why is why does that distinction matter? And I think the idea is, okay, so if you're a journalist, that means that tomorrow it's going to be in the paper, or tomorrow it's going to be in the news. And I think there's like some, I think, gap of, you know, imagination and progress where you realize it doesn't matter if you're a journalist. Because, I mean, why would it matter except to say that you expect then that it's going to be something that's broadcast or publicized? But now everybody has that ability.
And the directors also talked about the impact of social media on the future of free expression in China and Egypt.
China has for a long time had a very clear policy on the internet. The idea of both, you want as little to be anonymous as possible, so you can always track who, you know, where things are coming from, whose IP address it is, and who that individual is, and that also you want to be able to, you know, block. You want to both keep things out. It's about suppressing things, but just as much, it's about seeding the story that you want and having people out there who are writing on message boards and who are kind of bringing the conversation in a particular way. And, you know, they've made at their like national party meetings, like in last year or 2 years ago, there was a, you know, a speech that got leaked out where they talk about, I mean, very openly, that is the policy, that's the goal. And in some ways, it shows a great deal of foresight on the government's part, like that maybe they don't really underestimate the power of the internet, and they are always trying to stay ahead of it. But the question is, you know, really, can you? I mean, back to the question of whether you can suppress it or not, because, you know, even within, you know, Weibo, which is sort of like, you know, Chinese microblogging, you know, within the firewall, people are having all kinds of conversations about a lot of things. It's not, you know, it is too hard to keep it all down or to keep people from having a creative way to talk about something.
You saw like a bit of a an overreaction also in some ways right after the Arab Spring, where there were hundreds of people being rounded up. You know, the rumors had spread that there was going to be like a Chinese jasmine revolution, and that people were congregating for that. And like one of my older characters in particular, he was like, you know, that was a rumor that I openly said I had nothing to do with and was not actually interested in, because when and if we have any kind of like revolution, it's not gonna be called the Jasmine Revolution. It's gonna have its own particular you know, name and style, and it's gonna look very, very different, because China's a very different place, and it's not about like just the access to the, you know, people used to say like, is the internet going to change the future of China? Is technology going to and social media going to change the future course of China? Well, no, that's just a tool, and it's gonna be about like how you know, citizens and netizens, activists decide how to best use those tools.
I mean, at the same time, you know, all this technology is all, it's very interesting, but consider that in Egypt, for example, you know, 60% of the population is living under $2 a day. So they can't afford a $1,000 iPhone, and you know, if they have a phone, it's probably an old clunky Nokia, you know, maybe it has a camera. But people are very inventive, you know, they're very inventive and creative about how they share information. And, you know, Egyptians love to talk, and they basically kind of just, it's word of mouth, you know, everything's word of mouth. And they love to argue, they love to sit in coffee shops, and kind of, you know, it's kind of a different culture. I know that like my friends, some of the younger guys, they were using their BBM, messenger to stay in touch with, you know, if there was a gathering or if there was a march or if there was certain areas that were too dangerous or if there were checkpoints or things like this. I mean, it's a very, in that sense, the cat and mouse game is being played, but by a very small group of people. The younger, kind of more affluent, say multilingual, educated kids, and they're a very small group, you know, actually, but they're very highly mobile and highly communicating, and of course each one is then communicating to his immediate friends or followers or just people that are next to him at the cafe. They tell people, you know, it's talking. So the tech is not that, it's really not doing that much in the case of Egypt because of the poverty and the illiteracy and all of those things. But what really helped in terms of what the revolution is representing is people that are just simply fed up. And you can't replace feet on the ground and bodies in the street with you know, kind of tweeting through the revolution, you know? I mean, you can't be at home, like, you know, making revolution through your messages unless you really go down there and, you know, unless you're there and in sort of in harm's way. And that's really what people did, and they continue to do. So, I don't really know. Maybe in the States it'd be a bit different situation, or China is much more tech, but it's also, you know, has a lot of poverty as well. So I don't know. You know, I think it would take a lot of time to kind of get to that critical mass of technology being so familiar for us to use and to our advantage. You know.
Now, before we continue our discussion with the panel highlights, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. And we'll have a few clips, trailers from these movies that we're highlighting today on our website at globaljournalist.org. Now, Ai Weiwei is called China's most famous international artist and also its most outspoken domestic critic. He expresses himself and organizes people through art and social media. In response, Chinese authorities have shut down his blog. They've beaten him up, they've bulldozed his studio, and held him in secret detention. Josh Fox brought up a thorny question for the fellow panelists.
Are you worried that the film will make it worse for Ai Weiwei, or in all these situations, do you feel like that there's a certain amount of daylight that actually makes the situation better because there's a reaction What are your thoughts about it? Because I feel like it works. It can work both ways.
I think in Ai Weiwei's case, it's a really unique situation because, I mean, as much as I do think that the film is going to bring his story to so many more people, and it matters a lot that it's made by someone else. It's not just him putting out his own story, but it is like the take of me as the filmmaker. You know, he still, I think, makes his fate. I really don't feel like I make his fate. If you Google his name, a lot of other things come up before my movie. He's in the news all the time, articles, and they don't even mention my movie. That said, of course, though, that it was a concern that, you know, I didn't know the answer to at one point. And during his... You know, during his detention, it was sort of one case where we didn't know, is he going to get out? Is this going to be 5 years or 10 years? Which sort of, if that was the case, it felt like any talking about him, like, you know, that should help, right? Then once he's released, I had like two points of view. One was like, okay, now wait, stop. He needs to see the film and tell me what he thinks this is going to mean for him. But also, now that we have the hindsight of, you know, he got released after 81 days, and we saw how big of an international outcry there was, that international pressure must have played a role in some way, which I felt like while it was happening, there was a part of me that was like, China doesn't like to be told what to do. I mean, no country likes to be told by another country what to do, right? So I was sort of like, oh, I don't know if this is going to matter, or is this going to antagonize, you know, the authorities more. But I do feel like once he was out, it felt like you could kind of say that had to have played a role. But, you know, for now, I really think for him, he's really still very committed to talking about these values and bringing these messages out, and so the movie is like doing that work. So he's definitely, you know, in support of it.
And I don't think, to add to that, that you know, any ethically minded person could ever go to China and not think very, very profoundly about these exact questions. And I think in both of our cases, we're dealing with people who talk about this idea of risk in this way, that it's you're willing to take risks and calculated risks at that if you're interested in changing the status quo.
And the risk to your subjects because of your film, do you have a sense of that yet?
Well, that's something I was really very sort of preoccupied with, and from the very beginning made sure that they were comfortable with, and that they didn't feel like I would be adding any additional risk to them. And
especially when your subject is so active on social media, there's nothing in my film that's not already in the public sphere.
Right.
But most people don't obsessively read everything about Ai Weiwei. Like, there's still the value of bringing it all together as a story. But the reality is there's very little that I'm not even sure if there's anything there that's like never been out in the world. It's just like most people haven't seen all his films and followed all of his Twitter and gone and talked to him about his family. You know, it's like,
he's one of the most famous people in China. Mm-hmm. Right?
On the flip side, Hakim was asked whether he and his family might be endangered after the film about the revolution is shown inside Egypt, which has yet to undergo calls for what he calls the second half of the revolution. Hakim and his co-director were arrested, jailed, and beaten on the first day of the uprising when the police didn't even know they were filmmakers. On a side note, Hakim didn't know this fact when the forum took place. The military-controlled government still hasn't allowed the screening of his documentary.
You know, I guess it's a bit unique for me because, like, my film is in a sense, I mean, it's really about, you know, my family and my group of friends. I mean, we're the characters in the film. And we're showing where we live, we're showing what's going on in our house. So it's a very personal story. And of course we're worried. I'm a little bit worried about, when the film is shown in Egypt, what the ramifications will be. You know, I'm not sure yet. I mean, we're kind of leaking it out a little bit so that there's some kind of padding, but, April 2nd, the French Cultural Center will show the film. And of course, I think that it may even be banned. We'll see. It may not even be screened. You know, I mean, it's funny because we're making this film and we're showing it all around the world. We can't show it in the country that we made it made it in. And I think there'll be some kind of repercussions. I just don't know what they will be, you know. But at the same time, you know, we're all in the revolution together, and we're all kind of, there have been so many other, so many more incredible tales of personal sacrifice in terms of the revolution, people being shot, being blinded, losing both of their eyes, and going back for more. So in a sense, it's I think the danger to me is something that's much, much less than what I've already seen people do.
Near the end of the forum, Hakim urged journalists to take their watchdog role seriously.
I think that you have to remember that there's way more of us than there are of them. And we all have cameras, and we all have a keyboard, and we have a brain, and a lot of us in the West, we have an education. And I think that, you know, it's always going to be this tug of war, you know, between what the people want and what these governments and corporations want us to do with that technology. And I don't think it's ever going to be just completely defined into and, you know, compartmentalized, where they do this and we do that, and no one can you know, initiate some kind of new way of doing things. I mean, you know, filming policemen abusing somebody is sort of a right that we, and sort of an obligation that we have to do to kind of maintain, you know, our laws, the people's laws, not some kind of regime's laws for them to hide behind. So that's always going to be going, you know, cat and mouse back and forth. But I think the thing is just keep shooting if something, and keep writing. And if something is upsetting you, or, you know, something that you want to fight for, just do it. Do it. Don't wait for someone else to do it, because, you know, we all have to kind of police them and not allow ourselves to be only policed by them. You know, we're defining the laws. It's not the other way around, at least in this country. You know, in Egypt, it took a revolution to kind of start to clean out all of these shackles that we've been living under for 30 years. And I think America has the opportunity to develop this relationship without resorting to violent kind of revolution.
A few weeks ago, Al Jazeera gave a nod to the bravery and accomplishments of Hakim and his crew by awarding Half Revolution the top prize at the news organization's Documentary Film Festival. Now, we have a trailer from the film, and we're going to play a bit of it now. It starts with the sounds from the very first day of what would turn out to be the revolution in Egypt, as recorded by Hakim's crew. The crowd begins to chant, "No violence, no violence." And then the police officers in riot gear fire tear gas canisters to start breaking up the protest. In the final scene of this clip, Karim turns the camera on himself. And he's grimacing in pain from being tear gassed. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.